copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
My name's Grenville. I'm kind of the boy who didn't quite know what he wanted to do when he grew up, so I do a couple of things. I teach Old Testament studies in Sydney. And I also make films, and I see Professor Andy McIntosh here. He was in our first one that we did. Gave us a great interview about aerodynamics and bird wings and biomimetics and all that kind of stuff, being an expert in aerodynamics, I guess, and thermodynamics and a whole lot of other things. But I come at this topic, I guess, from a couple of ways. First of all, from a media perspective, and then from a biblical studies perspective. So I guess you'll hear both of my hats. Operative in this next little while. And just wearing the first hat, I wanted to take a quick look at our cultural moment, just a snapshot of what current Western culture, if I can generalize horribly, is telling us about sexuality. And the first obvious thing to say, I think, is that sex is everywhere. It's more so than when I was a kid. When I was a kid, pretty girls would advertise cars. Today, barely dressed pretty girls advertise cars. And I've, even in my 307 years of life, noticed a trend towards the pornification of a whole lot of things in advertising. Sport, woe betide the sportswoman especially, but also sportsman, who isn't also glamorous, because their career won't get as much attention and they won't be sexy enough to be marketed. Really? Is sexiness a requirement for a sports person? Well, it seems to be more and more. If you want budgets and promotion and the advertising dollar. Pamela Paul has written an excellent book called Pornified, in which she looks at this phenomenon. And I don't think she's a prude. I don't think she's scared of the topic of sexuality. She just thinks that it belongs, that it probably has nothing to do with selling cars. It probably has a lot to do with love and admiration, but not much to do with Pornified. Pamela Paul, that's where I've taken that word from. I don't think I've put it in the bibliography there. Pamela Paul, it's a very insightful book. In fact, she has an interview with a guy who slides into an interest in child porn. He starts with what you'd call regular mainstream porn and then follows what they call the graduation effect and becomes and seems to need more and more weirdness in the mixture to retain the same levels of excitement. And eventually he finds himself attracted to very, very young pictures and he freaks out and fights his way back towards some kind of normality. So that's in the background. I don't intend to analyse that in detail, but I would refer you to some excellent workshops from this forum. I've heard Glyn Harrison do some great stuff on this, and also Richard Winter sat in his seminar. And those guys analyse the popular culture right now, which we don't have time to do. Then I think there's also the same-sex debate. Now, if we're looking at the topic of why the Song of Songs is apologetically important, I think one of the toughest issues right now to tackle as an apologist would be the issue of the same-sex gay marriage, etc. debate. I've chatted to a couple of friends about that. I've got one who's on television all the time in my country as a presenter from a group called the Center for Public Christianity. And they're very clever at getting out in the media and getting some attention towards things Christian and, where possible, the gospel. But he says the toughest question he could ever be asked in an interview would be, what do you think about homosexuality, or what do you think about gay marriage? Because it was so easy to be labelled as a bigot. Some research in my country, which may be relevant to yours, I don't think it's vastly different in this way. One of the key blockers when it came to Christianity was the church's stance on homosexuality, with 3 in 10, 29% of Australians, expressing that this completely blocked them in engaging with Christianity. So because Christians are perceived as outdated bigots on this topic, Christianity is not considered. Actor Anne Hathaway was raised Roman Catholic and considered being a nun, but rejected the religion at 15 after learning her brother Michael was gay. I couldn't support a religion that didn't support my brother. Now I call myself a non-denominational Christian because I haven't found the religion for me. And I think she's very typical of a lot of people's approaches here. It seems to me that We desperately need a respectful, positive, intelligent apologetic on Christian teaching on sex. I think there are people here at this conference that give it. I've heard them. I guess I'm interested in film production. I think we need a media resource that does that really well. I think we need a way of tackling this, because as soon as you don't want to come across negative, you don't want to come across as the grouch opposing everything, and you can so easily be painted into that corner. What you're really trying to affirm is the fact that God's teaching on sexuality is life-giving and is positive and is good, and that's a very tough issue at the moment on which to do so. We're not analysing that in detail. Again, I'd refer you to Richard Winter. But number three, the clergy abuse scandal versus Jesus. Is it fair to say right now that all the way across Europe, the US, I can't think of a continent or a country where this isn't a problem, where clergy abuse hasn't happened? It's particularly in churches where clerical celibacy is enforced, where you have to be single as a priest. I think the statistics bear that out. But it's also a problem across the board in Christianity. For so many people, that has wrecked not only their own self-confidence and their enjoyment of love and sex and their trust, but it's also wrecked their faith. And it's cost the church not only millions of dollars in legal fees and compensation, but it's cost them something even more valuable, people. I think we have a major image problem right now as Christians. We're seen as anti-sex, repressive, authoritarian, and, thanks to the clergy abuse particularly, hypocritical. And I'm going to suggest, moving to page two, that we need a coherent response. We need to be able, in our personal lives, in our conversations with friends, in our apologetic teaching, to give a good, coherent response. I'm going to suggest, firstly, that wouldn't just involve moralizing and culture warring, but it would be largely about worldview discussion. It'd be everything's an opportunity to talk about worldview. And I think if we take that policy, everything becomes an opportunity to talk about worldview. So let's think about that right now. There's three views of a human being, I think, popular right now. So here comes a comparative pop anthropology in very simple terms. The first one we'd call secular materialism. Okay, so if we think about that view, how did we get here? We got here from a universe of matter by random processes. Our species has evolved, and a large part of the way that we've evolved is sex. So sex is important. So when you or I are attracted to a mate, it's really biological. Why do men like breasts of a certain kind? Well, because that shows that the woman is capable of feeding their offspring. Why do they like a particular shape of a feminine body? Well, because that shows that the woman is well-fed and healthy and fit and able to do the biological tasks of carrying their genes into the next generation. It's a selfish gene looking at a woman and going, yep, you're probably my best bet for a good partnership into the next generation. That's really all it is. What is love? Love is nature's way of rewarding reproductive behavior. It's nature's way of making sure that parents stay together so that their offspring have maximum survival chances. But once you've raised the kids, love's kind of biologically irrelevant and it may well die away. Now, I think that's pretty easy to argue against. A lot of people who don't or can't or have had kids are still in love. It's not just about that, I don't think, but that's a secular materialist view. So sex, then, there's nothing right or wrong in sex. There's really only just normal or abnormal, and even that's only a statistical question. So don't come with immorality telling me what I should do. And in a way, it takes all the mystery, doesn't it, all the romance out of what love is, because love's just one selfish gene looking for a partner. As the Bloodhound Gang sang it in their song, "You and Me, Babe, and Nothing But Mammals." So let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel. That's their view of sexuality. And I think rather than just picking at the behaviour that is a symptom of that view, it's probably better to go deeper and look at the disease itself. Rather than just looking at the surface results of a view like that in behaviour loneliness and addiction and some of the things we see in the society around us, things that call out for answers, it's probably better to look even deeper and say, well, what's the worldview behind that that shapes that view? And to critique it deeply, to challenge it deeply. The other view, I think, that is very common in Western society generally is what I'd call traditional religious moralism. And that's not much better, to be honest. It's a bit better. At least it says you have a soul. At least it says it is aware of your spirituality. And at least it knows what love is. That love is two human beings connecting potentially at a spiritual level as well as at a physical. So points for that. But the problem with it is that it's embraced, I think, a bizarre dualism between body and spirit. And it has taken Plato very, very, very seriously and said, your body is kind of inferior. God's less interested in that. He's more interested in your soul. And so, as Plato would have agreed, a relationship involving soul-to-soul connection is the best. And a relationship involving body-to-body connection, I mean, it's okay if you have to have children. We need more souls to be made, and so I guess you need to do all that physical stuff, but don't enjoy it too much. And don't make a big thing of it. And if you really want to be a holy person, like a priest or a nun, no sex. Avoid the bodily stuff. And if you think what that has cost us, it's given us a fairly negative view of our bodies. I think Christians are starting to read the Bible again and say, look, actually, God loves the human body. In the beginning, when he made us out of the dust of the ground and out of the mysterious breath that he breathed into us, he didn't look at us and say, 50% good. He looked at us and said, very good, very good. And then he said, it's not good that man would be alone. And he designed us to become one flesh. Not just one spirit, although that too, but one flesh. And the man and his wife were naked, and they knew no shame. So I think right there in the beginning, and look at the end of the Christian story, what does God do with the body? He doesn't just dump it and let the soul charge off somewhere. He resurrects the body. And Paul talks about us having a glorious body, like Christ's, the body of Christ's glory, and his resurrection body, and all that kind of stuff. And so I think we have to rethink a low view of the body. I don't believe God has that. Jesus comes, and the Word becomes flesh and lives among us. And Jesus does some of his best work in a human body. It's on a body that he dies on the cross. It's on a body with a body It's in a body that he resurrects. And he heals human bodies. He obviously shows a lot of care about the human body. He also, interestingly, one of the first acts of his ministry, even though Jesus decides not to marry for a bunch of reasons I can imagine, imagine being half Messiah's son, half, what does that mean for your divinity, humanity? I don't know, it's too complicated for me to get. But even though he doesn't marry, what's the first act of his public ministry? Goes along to a wedding, performs a miracle of transformation. And so I think he's trying to tell us that he doesn't have a problem with human love, including physical love. And I think we're kind of struggling between those two extremes. I remember going along to a pornography convention to do some interviewing, to interview a guy for an article I was writing. And he was the PR director for Australia's sex industry. He was the guy that got them all the public relations exposure in newspapers and TV. Interesting guy. And we were talking, and I was interviewing him, and he gave me this book, and he'd summarized the last 10 years of clergy abuse. And it was this book called Hypocrites. And he dropped it on the desk in front of me. And he said, there you go. That's what all your Christian brothers have been up to. And I said, I find that absolutely disgusting. I've read the words of Jesus, and he finds it disgusting too. He says, if anybody wants to damage one of these little ones of mine, better, you know the text, better that you get a great big rock, big millstone around his neck and punt him off the back of a fishing boat in a deep part of the sea. That's how tough Jesus is in talking about this stuff. These little ones, they're angels, behold God's face every day, pal. And he liked that. He kind of said, oh, that's good. I haven't heard that. I thought, oh man, we've done a bad job in talking to people about this. Anyway, we got talking, and he said to me, he kind of let down his guard a bit. He said, actually, I trained for the priesthood for a couple of years. I said, whoa, you know how you've gone from priest to pornographer? He said, yep. And he said, by the way, so did Bob Guccione, the guy who started Penthouse magazine. And Hugh Hefner's mother wanted him to be a missionary. And then he kind of switched to a slightly different career. And I said, so you started in the priesthood. I said, what took you out of that? And he looked at me, he said, sex. I said, what about it? He said, well, I had a choice. I could either be spiritual or I could be sexual. And I thought, that's exactly the problem. That's exactly the problem. You got that artificial choice. Whereas I think the Bible gives us the beautiful middle ground of being both and holds that up as the ideal. I remember walking one time on a tour we were doing, my wife and I, and we went through Amsterdam. The tour takes you to the red light district, and we were looking at all these, you know, girls from all different parts and wondering how their lives were and kind of empathizing with them. And all of a sudden, out of apparently right near there is a big church that does a lot of ministry to prostitutes in the area. And a nun came out wearing the black habit and the big flying headpiece. It was amazing. It was just bizarre. Here we are in the red light district, and this nun walks out looking like she's come from another planet. And she's there to do ministry, and God bless her. I remember looking at those two extremes and going, that's what the world thinks. Those are your options. You can either be completely hedonistic and secular, or you can be that nun, no sex. And then I looked at my wife, and I thought, there's the happy medium. There's a woman who is very spiritual and who is involved in women's ministry, just like that nun, but is also, I don't need to go into detail, but a beautifully loving wife and mother, with all that entails. I remember thinking, I had this epiphany standing in that street. I remember thinking, God, that's it. I say this humbly and very gratefully, I've got the middle option. I've got the great middle option here. And in a sense, I think our culture is struggling. It hears those two messages, and it doesn't know there's a middle option. And I think often as Christians, we've been shy about talking about this too much. And there's probably good reasons for that. But maybe it's time that we started to push the biblical view and to promote it as something fantastic. Because if you ask me, the nefesh view, and I draw that word from Hebrew. Anyone know what a nefesh is? What's a nefesh? Andy wrote a commentary on that. It's a very good book. Actually, I've got it at home. Genesis for Today, isn't it called? Yeah, that's an unpaid commercial. And nefesh, then, is the Hebrew concept. It's often translated soul, but it's a very holistic term. It means all of a person. It means all of your life, arguably. And for example, when Samson's dying, he shouts out, "Let my nefesh die with the Philistines," and he dies. So it means the whole mind, body, and spirit, we might say, because when it says God made man out of the dust of the earth and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and he became a nefesh. So it involves both the spirit and the physical side of a person. And I think the Bible holds up a kind of love that embraces both. And I'm going to argue that that is the most rewarding and satisfying and God-given version of human love. I hope this is obvious. I hope this is obvious to you, this point. I'm probably just going over basics at the moment. But if our culture is choosing between the secular materialist view of nothing but mammals, if you like, the Amsterdam prostitute, and the traditional religious view, if you like, the nun, it's an artificial choice. And I think we need to put out there the strong, balanced biblical message that there is a different option. Because what people are asking oftentimes when they look at Christianity and when they look at our teaching on sex, they often are really asking a theological question. First of all, there's a practical question. Would I want to be a Christian? Would it be a good life? And the way sex is positioned at the moment, sex, I think, is the holy grail of materialism. It's the, you know, okay, go back to your materialist view. We're not here for long. So what are you going to do with those few weekends that you've got before you die, about 2,500 weekends? What are you going to do? You're going to pack as much pleasure into that as you can. Okay, so what's one of the major pleasures of life? Sex, of course it is. And so you're going to have as much as you can, with as many people as you can, and as, you know, as least as good as you can manage, or imagine it, or watch it, or, you know, it's going to be in there somewhere. It's one of the greatest pleasures. And so in a sense, it's the meaning of life for secularists. It's the Holy Grail. And it gets out of all proportion to the point where, if you're not having sex, you're weird. What kind of strange, bizarro kink is it that you'd be celibate? Huh? Why would you miss out on all that pleasure? Why would you ever say no to it if it wasn't going to damage you? And I think people are asking, really, is Christianity livable? Is it good? And behind that is the theological question, is God good? Would God make a bunch of daft rules about your sexuality? Would God, let's say, give you the equipment and then forbid you to use it? Would God give you the desire and then forbid you ever to use it? That, you can understand people having questions with that. And I know there's a gift of singleness, and I'm just trying to nuance that answer. But the question really they're asking is Christian teaching life-affirming, and is God good? Is the gospel good news about sex? Does it redeem all of creation, including our sexuality? And I think we've probably done a bad job in talking about that. Whenever I ask my first year students, what has your church taught you about sex? About half of them are Christian or come from a Christian background. And they say, well, it's taught me don't have sex before marriage. And I go, good, that's a good start. What else? And they go, not much. I go, okay, fair enough, let's talk about it. And they're almost shocked that it would be mentioned. That's the other strange thing. It's almost funny to talk about it in a Christian context. Well, of course. And my dear old uncle who led me to Christ, he was a tough old army surgeon. He'd served in various wars, and he was just a gutsy, godly man. And when I was about 18, 16, he took me under his wing and took me snow skiing and basically just bore witness to the gospel in just such a friendly and logical way that I kind of went, ooh, and it really started me thinking. And when I was called to ministry, he said to me, look, man, he said, here's a problem. He said, my generation, he'd be about 100 now if he was still alive. My generation, we just never talked about sex. We knew what was right and wrong. We just got on with it. But he said, your generation talks about nothing else. He said, you're going to have to talk about it. It's in the Bible. But he said, my generation isn't going to really like it. They're not going to want to have the discussion. But he said, do it anyway. You've got to be faithful to Scripture. I remember that. It's absolutely spot on. And I think sometimes we've struggled to show how the gospel is good news about sex. We've struggled to live up to the Bible's teaching yet another way and to give a clear message to others about that. And as part of that solution, I'd like to look at the Song of Songs. There are some challenges in teaching the song. I'm going to argue that if we understood the biblical message of sexuality and popularized it well, we might undo some of the damage, some of the challenge right now in this area. But there's a challenge in teaching this song. It's rarely preached. David Carr talks about functional decanonization. Translation: in about in the 1800s, most people thought the Song of Songs was an allegorical book. It was all about God and the believer, or God, Christ and the church. And then suddenly, actually Calvin and others started this process, but suddenly about the 1850s, scholarship went, no, it's not. It's a book about human love. Oh. And as soon as that happened, Carr argues, the church stopped using it. Stopped using it in public worship because let's not talk about sex. Oh, my word. And so it's rarely taught. I've done a bit of study into this and talked to a number of seminary people, and it's rarely taught to pastors. A lot of people have acknowledged that people coming through to train in their seminaries would not get one lecture on the Song of Songs. They'd hear about everything else, but not one lecture. Churches that use the lectionary, it's in there. There's one reading from it across the lectionary, but it's a fairly tame passage about romance in spring, nothing too erotic, and it's quite easy to gloss over. It's quite easy to have it, you know, Jesus calling the church away to be with him or something like that, and then move on to the other reading. There's also one other blockage, and that is the quest to the historical Solomon. I don't want to talk about that too much today, but just to put it very simply, a lot of people don't think Solomon really existed in history. I think there's strong evidence that he did, and I'd refer you to books like Kenneth Kitchen on the Reliability of the Old Testament and some of the other books by Daniel Block right now. That's not really our focus today. But it's kind of the elephant in the room. It's undermined a lot of people's view of the Song of Solomon, because if Solomon didn't really exist, someone else wrote it, and its credibility drops a bit. There's also the question of language and dating. Some will have argued that the book looks like it was written long after Solomon. Again, we could go into the history of the Hebrew language, but the more recent scholarship is saying to us, nope, it looks like it was written long ago, around the 950s BC. That's the right time for Solomon. And it looks like it was written in a very, with a very wide vocabulary by a very witty, brilliant writer. And that's the kind of Hebrew that it is. Well, if that's true, that fits pretty well with the character of what we know of Solomon from biblical history. But the real blocker, as I've begun to mention, is the allegorical method. The allegorical method, do you know what I mean by that? An allegory. Okay, so I tell you a story about trees finding themselves a king, but I'm not really talking about trees at all, I'm talking about politics. Okay, that's in the Bible, you know that story, right? They think, I'll tell you a story about a man and a woman in love, and all this love poetry will happen, but it's not actually about a man and a woman in love. It's about, if you're a Jew, it's about Yahweh when he first called Israel out of Egypt to a honeymoon in the desert. And he loved her, and he called her to himself, and he said, come away with me, my love, and off they went. Or if you're a Christian, it's about the individual soul and Jesus. And you've got to make all the details fit. And that's the problem. That's the problem. When you try to make all the details fit, you just kind of go, blah, 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 and you have to get really creative. And let me just pick on one detail. You can laugh at me, but the issue of breasts. Okay? What do breasts mean? They're mentioned a number of times in the Song of Solomon. How do you allegorize breasts? Well, a lot of people have given it a really good attempt. One person quotes the New Testament text that says, earnestly desire the sincere or the pure milk of God's word so that you can grow by that. And they said, aha, there it is. The breasts are what give you the milk of God's word. They must be the Old Testament and the New Testament. Okay, so the breasts are the Bible. Well, there's a few problems with that. First of all, the Song of Songs doesn't talk about breast feeding. It talks about breasts in a much more erotic context. And number two, I don't know if you've noticed, but the Old Testament is four times bigger than the New Testament. So there's a practical problem right there. I'm just kidding with that one. But there's, and so others will go, oh, crumbs. Maybe it's the warmth of Christian fellowship where we invite one another into our bosom. No, that doesn't work. Maybe it's us being invited into the bosom of Christ for nurture and care. That doesn't work. He's a man. Scottish preacher said, it's God looking at the church in the same way as a man looks at his wife's beautiful breasts. And then in the next paragraph he goes, but not in an erotic way. And he kind of struggles with that. And you go, well, I could sit you here for half an hour quoting you different examples of how people have tried to make the breasts work as a detail in an allegory. Maybe they're Moses and Aaron, Jews will say. Maybe they're the king and the high priest. The reformers will say, maybe they're the bread and wine, the two elements of communion service. That's just way too creative. And the problem with all of that is, the problem with the allegorical method generally, I'm going to argue, is that, to use Luther's term, it puts a wax nose on the scriptures that you can turn any way you want it to go. You know, a wax nose, so that the scriptures are looking this way and you just tweak the wax nose over that way. And it's saying whatever you want. The problem, I mean, there are real biblical allegories, no question about that, but they're normally, at least the writer begins to unpack for you what they are. So if Daniel sees two animals fighting, oftentimes he'll say to you, well, this one symbolizes that kingdom and that one symbolizes that kingdom. Ah, all right, thank you. Or oftentimes if you think of Ezekiel's allegories, and he has some fairly searingly pornographic allegories, actually, when you think of how he describes Jerusalem, he'll always say to you, this is a song for Jerusalem and her sister city Sodom. And then he'll talk about these girls and how they behaved, but he's really talking about Jerusalem. So normally a biblical allegory tells you that it's an allegory and also gives you at least some clues of how to interpret it. This one doesn't. This one doesn't. And I'm going to argue that if I'm trying to bring you God's word in an authoritative way, the authority better not rest on my imagination. Better not rest on what I tell you the text is saying, because then I'm the authority. It better be clear from the text. That's part of the old doctrine of sola scriptura. Right? It better be really clear from the text itself. And so I think with respect to friends of mine who do see merit in the allegorical method, I'm going to argue that it's actually been a little bit of a stumbling block in understanding the primary method of the primary meaning of the Song of Songs. But let me nuance that by saying there are beautiful ways in which a man-woman marriage relationship mirrors and gives us insights into the love of God for us and for us individually. It just doesn't work at the level of all the details. If you try to be too clever with it, it fails. But if you generally say, yes, there's a way in which speaking of human love is a profound mystery, and I'm speaking of Christ and his church, that works. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Questions or comments so far on allegorical method or anything else so far? Yeah, Watchman Nee and others also did, it was... And for those guys, though I disagree with their interpretation, they were so in love with Christ and they understood the gospel and spirituality so clearly that even though I disagree with their use of that text, they still brought Christ in it in a way that I think is powerful. I don't think it's exegetical, but I think it's homiletically beautiful. You could go back to Bernard of Clairvaux. He wrote, 200 sermons, and he only got to the first three chapters of the Song of Songs. He loved it, and it was all allegorical. No question that that some good Christian thinkers have seen it allegorically.
Are there others then?
The question is, are there? Could it be allegorical? Are there other commentators who've seen it that way? There are certainly some notable Christians who have. And my answer would be sure. There's many commentators today. I think you'd say the majority of evangelical commentators today would regard it as non-allegorical. I've got one friend at Tyndale House who's doing a PhD that does see it as allegorical. There's been another, I think a Catholic writer recently who's published an Oxford thesis seeing it as allegorical. Probably a minority today. That doesn't prove it's wrong or right. It's just of interest. I guess I struggle with the text. I look at the text in detail and say, what could this possibly mean about Christ and his church? And let me be fair, there's a couple of places in the New Testament that I think are allusions to the Song of Songs. When Jesus says, behold, I stand at the door and knock, he may well be alluding, just hinting at one of the passages in the Song of Songs. That's fine. Certainly, the thing works in broad terms as a picture of you and Jesus. And if he's knocking at the door, you know, there's a scene in the song where the lover is knocking, you know, wake up. And possibly, too, the way that Jesus and Mary Magdalene speak in the garden. There's possibly a little flash of allusion there, or maybe not. I wouldn't say it's proven. That's about the only two that scholars, I think, would mention. The allegorical method, it's dominated Middle Ages interpretation, but then along came Calvin and just went, it's about human love. And in a way, when you think of the Bible's teaching on human sexuality, okay, you've got Adam and Eve, then you've got some horrible examples of human sexual behavior. If you go through Genesis, I should have perhaps footnoted here, there's a book by Richard Davidson called Flame of Yahweh. It's an excellent commentary on Old Testament passages on sexuality. It's a whole big book. It's, you know, this wide on Old Testament passages on sexuality. And he's made it a half of his career long study. And he makes a really interesting case. What he says is, in the Garden of Eden, you see the absolute unfallen beauty of human sexuality. And he lists it all. There's no power play. There's nakedness and no shame. There's total commitment. It's monogamous. It's heterosexual. I mean, some of these things are obvious, you know. And he takes you through what Edenic sex is, and then he talks about the fall, and he comes up with dozens of biblical passages describing the darker side of fallen sexuality outside of the Garden of Eden. There's rape, and there's bigamy and polygamy, and there's divorce, and there's you know, whatever happened with Lot and his daughters, incestuous, drunken, and there's even poor old Noah and his son, whatever exactly that was, and there's Sodom, and there's, and on and on and on and on it all goes. And then he says, but you get back to the Song of Solomon, and that functions like a re-entry to the Garden of Eden. It's in a garden, and the lovers have been, you know, the first lovers, Adam and Eve, are ejected from the garden, but these two are back. And in the original garden, there's weeds and you know, things around. That's part of the curse. But in the Song of Songs, no weeds. In the original curse, it says, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. But then you get into the Song of Songs and the woman actually says, his desire is for me. I belong to the one I love and his desire is for me. And there's no mention of ruling. Even though one of them is the king, there's no mention of anybody ruling over anybody in that marital relationship. It's almost like the curse is being undone. And in the Genesis account, you see death, part of the curse. Dust you are, and unto dust you will return. But in the Song of Songs, we're told love is stronger than death. And in a sense, that's a beautiful statement of the gospel, isn't it? Love is stronger than death. Wages of sin is death. Gift of God is eternal life. And so Phyllis Tribble in her book describes this. Actually, if you read my chapter, Preaching the Song of Songs, it's got these references in there. That is in the footnotes. And that book is in the bookshop. Forgive the commercial here.
What's the title?
Do you know, the title that I footnoted there is He Began with Moses. That's the British title. But they've brought the American edition here, which is called Reclaiming the Old Testament for Christian Preaching. Reclaiming the Old Testament. So Davidson's point is that the Song of Songs reveals, within the biblical canon, reveals redemption. And it shows the gospel of grace operating to take us back towards the Garden of Eden. And to put that in a very simple, popular way, what it's saying is, if you're in a loving, committed, beautifully erotic marriage, it's a bit like sneaking back into the Garden of Eden again, with all the blessing and the love and God's original good purposes for the human race. It's a bit like that. I don't want to claim too much.
What's Davidson's book?
I'm sorry, I should have footnoted it, shouldn't I? Flame of Yahweh. It's Richard M. Davidson, Flame of Yahweh.
And there's this
Richard M. Richard M. Davidson, Flame of Yahweh.
Thank you.
No, it's a great book on sexuality and the Old Testament, and particularly on the song. So here's another thing. If all we had in the Bible was the thou shalt nots and the stories of tragic mass rape and the stories of poor old Dinah, and you know, you think of some of the sad stories, David's fall involving sexuality, we might get a dark view of human sexuality. And there's no question there is a dark side to human sexuality. I wonder how many early teens are standing on cold street corners tonight around the world, not looking forward to what's going to happen to them because that's how they have to earn a living. I wonder how many kids are being sexually abused. You know, we could sit here and get quite depressed about some of the horrible things that are happening right now in the area of human sexuality. But if that was all we had in the Bible, we might get the picture that God has a dark view of one of his great gifts. Whereas I think the Song of Songs is an important balancer because it's an almost exclusively positive view of sexuality. And I think that in itself is a very powerful lesson for Christians right now. Oftentimes we're the first to talk about the bad sides of sex. But the Bible has one book that is almost totally positive, almost totally showing excellence, showing an ideal so good that we won't settle for something less than that. And I think that's a brilliant strategy. If we did more of that ourselves, maybe we would correct our public image right now. So how do we approach the Song of Songs? First of all, I'm going to suggest it's erotic and it's also inspired scripture. When I was chatting to the guy I told you about, the PR director for the pornography convention, He said to me, so you know, what are you up to? I said, I'm a Christian. I'm writing a commentary on the Song of Songs. He said to me, the what? I said, the Song of Solomon in the Bible. He said, never heard of it. I said, you're kidding. How long did you study for the priesthood? He said, 3 years. I said, you were 3 years in the priesthood and nobody ever read you the Song of Solomon. He said, yeah. He said, is that in the Bible? I said, are you kidding me? You never read it? He's like, no, is it in the Bible? I said, yeah, it is. I said, I'll send you a copy of my commentary, which I just finished last week, actually. And I said, oh, okay, and what is it? It's a book of erotica in the Bible? And he just looked at me like I was nuts. Like I just said, I don't know, I'm gonna crochet a space shuttle. You know? Huh? What? You know, erotica in the Bible? He just couldn't get over it. And I think that's part of the issue that took him out of Christianity. When you think about it. Now, I've chosen the word erotica, I hope fairly carefully, and I distinguish it from pornography. And I know it's a blurry line in some people's minds, but for me, erotica may show just as much detail of human sexual activity, but it'll be in a context of tasteful, loving, committed, admiring, and I'm going to say marriage, in the case of Christian erotica. Whereas pornography will be much more about the physical details, doesn't matter who it's with, don't have any feelings for him or her, may not even admire them. And from what I'm reading about contemporary pornography, it's getting more and more violent, it's getting more and more scornful and demeaning of women. There was an article in the Monthly magazine in Australia recently where a psychologist went through and just viewed about 100 of the best-selling pornography titles released in the last year. And she's not a Christian. She's pretty, I'd say, open on matters of sexuality, more open probably than I am. And she was horrified at the amount of slapping and mistreatment of women that were going on in the mainstream titles. These are not little weird titles at the back of the shop that only a few weirdos buy. This is the mainstream stuff. And she kind of hit the panic button to say to our culture, is this the effect you want to have on the next generation? And it was a fascinating article. Whereas erotica, on the other hand, appreciates the person that you're with. How many times in the Song of Songs do we hear him say, you're beautiful, my love? There's admiration there. There's respect. I'm going to argue, too, that it's wisdom literature. If you think about who's writing the Song of Songs, it's supposedly the wisest man, other than one, who ever lived. And when you think of all his other writing, Proverbs, wisdom literature, Ecclesiastes, wisdom literature with a fascinating life twist, I'm going to argue the Song of Songs is wisdom literature. And there are certain passages of it that are actually quite a lot like Proverbs. Proverbs 5 has a description of a woman as a beautiful garden. And it says to a young man, you know, like, rejoice with the wife of your youth. Let her breasts satisfy you at all times. Always be enraptured by her love. And it describes her, and then it says, you know, don't spend your love on other people. And it compares it to a beautiful garden. And the Song of Songs does exactly the same thing. It describes the woman as a garden, as we'll see. So I'm going to argue that there are some similarities between the Proverbs and the Song of Songs. I'm going to argue, too, that it's also subtle theology. Subtle theology. Now, We have to be pretty careful here, because it's written in a time of fertility religions. Let me just very briefly sketch for you why it's very subtle theology, why there's not clear reference to God in the Song of Songs. There's only a couple of hints at his name. I'm going to argue that's because in the ancient world there was this thing called the fertility religion. Now, you don't hear much about this in church. It's not polite. And I hope I'm not being offensive when I tell you how political how fertility religions worked. I'll give you a 2-minute sermon from the fertility religion side of things. Okay, here it is. Your aim in life is to get rich. Now that hasn't changed in about 3,000 years. The way you do that as a farmer is you need fertility. You need your crops and your animals to be extremely fertile. You also need your wife to be very fertile so that you get lots of sons to work the land, and I guess girls are useful too to do other jobs. That's what they thought, okay? And so you want fertility. Now, how do you get fertility? This is a pre-scientific age. You get fertility by turning on the gods, by making the gods have sex up there, and if they have sex, well then Earth gets fertilized. And in fact, okay, I'll just come right out and say it, they believe that rain, the Canaanites believe that rain was caused by, some of you know this and you're looking at me with kind of a funny look on your face, was caused by Baal, or Baal, the storm god, ejaculating. Okay, so whenever Baal had sex with, I know, it's laughable. Whenever Baal had sex with his girlfriend / sister, Asherah or Astarte, it rained. And the ground was fertilized and that was good. Now you understand the Elijah story, how funny it is when Elijah says, there's going to be no rain for 3.5 years. It's like, well, Baal's not going to be having any fun up there then, is he? And that's kind of, it's a big joke at Baal. And sometimes the prophets will use humor just to mock. You know, you'd see how Elijah does it. Oh, maybe he's asleep. Shout a bit louder. Oh, maybe he's gone on holidays. He's mocking the idea of these very human little gods that were just like a big soap opera, fighting each other, running off with each other's, you know, partners. And it was just this big, weird soap opera up there. So how do you get their favor? A few ways. One way is, of course, sacrifice, because they love the smell of a good barbecue. Number two, you turn them on sexually. You show them porn in church. In fact, you reenact sex acts in the temple, or you go up to a high place and you have sex with a prostitute. Now, this is on every second page of the Old Testament that this stuff is going on. Again and again and again, the prophets say that Israel has prostituted themselves, or as the King James puts it, gone a-whoring after other gods, probably quite literally. And so Amos depicts a father and a son going off to the temple together. And that should be good, right? Isn't it good when a dad brings his son along to church for spirituality and models all that stuff? It should be, except that they've gone to one of those temples and they've both gone to the same girl. How sick is that? Father and son, who goes first? What do they talk about on the way home? What does that boy now think about his mother? What, mum's not enough, Dad? One awesome woman that I love is not enough for you? And the kid's heart breaks and something gets broken and twisted within him. And he learns all the wrong things from his dad. And Amos shows you this picture of religion gone terribly wrong. And so do many of the other prophets. And they constantly call Israel back to faithfulness. Because if you learn about loyalty and chesed to one God, maybe you'll be loyal to one good woman or man. And maybe you'll know what committed covenant love is. And you see how those two ideas fit together. And so I think with that in mind, and by the way, Solomon ironically becomes the guy later in his life who sets up temples to a lot of these gods. He marries foreign women. Nothing against foreign women per se, but he marries women who have different religions from him. And 1 Kings 11 describes how when he's old, they turn his heart away from God. And what does he do? He builds shrines. This is the guy who built the temple out of gold and marble, the awesome temple to Yahweh for the world. And he also builds temples to all these other horrific gods who are into not just that, but some of them apparently into child sacrifice as part of their religion. This is sick stuff. It has the worst of depraved sex and violence. It would be quite at home on a lot of Western movie screens right now, actually, to be quite honest. And so when the writer sits down to write this book, he doesn't want to make you think that this is yet another fertility religion. It's interesting, though, when you read the covenant. You see, one of the first things God starts by saying in Deuteronomy is what? If you're faithful to me, I'll bless your farms. I'll bless the fruit of your body. I'll bless the offspring. I'll bless the ground. I'll bless your animals. God's going, I'm the fertility God. I'm the one who actually sends rain. And it's interesting too, from a science perspective, when Israel moves away from many gods and starts to follow one, that's when they start to think in terms of laws. And that, I'd argue, and many have argued, is the beginning of science. And we start to think, oh, if it's all managed by one, then maybe there's a consistent lot of laws there. We start looking for them, and we're doing science. So it's subtle theology. There's a couple of places where you do see God's name. There's a little bit of clever wordplay in the Hebrew. When at one point she says to the women of Jerusalem, she says, swear to me by the bucks and the gazelles. It's in 2 verse 7. Swear to me by the bucks and the gazelles that you won't try to hurry love or awaken desire until it is ready. In Hebrew, those words, bucks and gazelles, sound exactly like the words for Yahweh of hosts. So there's kind of a hint there. Swear to me by the bucks and gazelles. Now, the bucks and gazelles were famous for their sexual energy, okay, in the ancient world. But it also sounds a lot like a hint at God's name. There might be some witty reference there to God. There's also another place where he's describing how beautiful his wife is. And he actually mentions in there God. Let me read you 7:1-5. So Songs 7:1-5. He says, I love your feet in those sandals, princess. Your smooth golden thighs are ornaments shaped by a craftsman. Just stop the bus for a minute. Who's the craftsman? Your smooth golden thighs are ornaments shaped by a craftsman. Who's the craftsman? It's got to be God. There's the doctrine of creation beautifully stated. Now, I don't know about you, if you see a gorgeous pair of legs of the person that you love, does it instantly drive your thoughts to theology? Maybe not, but it should, because if you believe in creation, all those gorgeous parts of the human body were designed for function and pleasure by a generous, kind, loving God, who is himself a relationship. Not just has, but is a relationship. And so there's a couple of little subtle references to God, but the writer keeps them very, very subtle, because I don't think we're meant to take this as yet another fertility religion. Does that make sense? So it's written in that ancient background. Number four, I'm going to argue that it's a metaphor for the love of the believer and God. We've made that point. Number five, it's outside the Garden of Eden. It's outside the Garden of Eden. And there's a couple of places where there are little dark moments in the Song of Songs. There's a couple actually of little nightmares. For example, chapter 3:1-5. All night on my bed, I was looking for my soulmate. I searched for him but could not find him. I'll get up and walk around the city streets and squares. I'll search for my soulmate. So I looked, but I couldn't find him. The watchmen found me as they did their rounds. Have you seen my soulmate? I had barely passed them, when I found my soulmate. I caught him and I held him tight until I had brought him to my mother's house, to the room of the one who conceived me. And so scholars understand that as kind of a nightmare where she's afraid of losing him. Where's he gone? And I'm out in the city at night and I'm kind of stuck and, oh, there's these other men threatening me and they're meant to be watchmen, but can I trust them? And then, oh, phew, I found him again. And there's another passage like that as well. There's two little passages where I think the best explanation is that's her fear in the relationship, that maybe everything won't go well. And there are moments where the song is not all, you know, happiness and light. So it's outside the Garden of Eden, but it's working as a way of trying to invite us back into God's original plans in Eden, his plans for the human race. I'm going to argue too, as I've said before, it shows redemption. It constantly is positive about love and sex. And in the context of Genesis, it's a very, it's almost like it said, okay, we've had Adam and Eve, we've had the fall, we've had all these tragic years, but one day we'll end up back in a garden. And in that way, it works a bit like the book of Revelation, where you end the whole Christian story back in a garden, back in Eden once more. And as the Revelation says, there is no more curse. I think the song is trying to say some of the same things. It's also an ancient book, and sometimes it's difficult. But let's work through some of the passages together and see if we can get some of the genius of this work. There are some bits we don't get. We don't know what the words mean. We don't quite understand bits of it. Or I don't. Maybe some do. I've done a fair bit of study into it. But if you look on the first page, on the right-hand column, second paragraph, he says, "I dream of you, my love, as my filly among Pharaoh's chariots, causing chaos in the cavalry. Look, lovely silver armor ornamenting your cheeks, gold chains on your neck." So he's called his wife a horse. "I dream of you, my love, as my filly," that's a young female horse, "among Pharaoh's chariots." And scholars look at that and they go, "What? He's called his wife a horse?" Can I ask for a show of hands, ladies, who would find that a compliment? And who would find that a slappable offense? But then we find, one of the Yale researchers finds this tablet in Egypt that tells a story of a guy called the Prince of Kedar, who's coming to attack Pharaoh's chariots. And Pharaoh's chariots, all these war horses, you know, they're formidable. They're the best, they're like tanks. They're the best part of his army. And he's got all these strong stallions pulling them into war. And the enemy realizes, man, if I don't do something about these war horses, I'm dead. And so he finds his secret weapon. He gets this gorgeous young female horse, which is on heat. And he has one of his men lead that into the battleground. What happens? All of Pharaoh's stallions are there ready to fight. And suddenly they're like, "Oh, make love, not war," you know. And it shuts down the whole cavalry charge. And this one female horse just, you know, wrecks all of Pharaoh's armies. And that's about that time. So it could well be that Solomon is saying to his beautiful wife, "You're just like that. You're my secret weapon. You're so beautiful that when I take you out in public, I don't know, men drive their cars into walls and, you know, you just so the road toll rises because you're so beautiful." It's kind of his funny, over-the-top compliment. And that's the other thing about this. It's funny. There are so many places where you find yourself, and it won't be funny when I translate the jokes and explain them to you. That's not, you know, that a translated joke is never really funny. But in the text, as you read it, you kind of chuckle and you say, these people are not hung up about sex. This is not some tense, oh, stressful thing. This is joy. This is humor. This is, you can hear the laughter of Adam and Eve in Eden in enjoying God's perfect, beautiful world. And you can hear the joy of God, in whose presence is fullness of joy, and at whose right hand are pleasures forevermore. And I think that's the picture of God that people need out of this book. There's also a particularly erotic passage. Let's just look at one of those for lack of time. Page 4, right-hand column, second from the bottom. This is the best translation I can find. She sings, "My lover is bursting with life." The women of the Jerusalem girls have just been teasing her and saying, "Why is your beloved any good? Why is he better than anybody else?" And she turns around and says, "My lover is bursting with life. He stands above 10,000. His head is like the purest gold of a statue, hair wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves by the rivers, mounted like jewels in a milky white background. His cheeks are like gardens of spice and perfume. His lips are among the lilies, smooth as lotion parfumé." There's a couple of places in elsewhere in the song where the woman compares herself to a lily, and also a particularly intimate part of her body is compared to a lily. And so she's saying here, his lips are among the lilies, smooth as lotion parfumé. He has great golden arms like a statue's, decorated with jewels. And here it is, his horn is elephantine ivory, a scepter studded with sapphires. It's gone quiet in the room. Understandably so. That's a very, very frank anatomical reference. And again, the man and his wife are naked, and they know no shame. They know no shame. What do we know about ivory? It's hard. What do we know about elephants? They're big. What is a scepter? It's a kind of a rod that a king rules with. Okay, so you can see that would fit pretty well for describing King Solomon. His legs are pillars of marble set on bases of pure gold. He is tall and straight like a cedar forest. His mouth is sweetness itself. He is totally desirable. This is my lover, and this is my friend, Jerusalem girls. There's so much about that passage. First of all, it's an extremely frank description of a man by a woman. How rarely does that happen, even to this day? It's normally the woman is the object of the gaze, the look. Secondly, it's quite subtly comparing Solomon to the things of which his temple was made. His legs are made of marble. They're set on bases of gold. He's like a cedar forest, and so on. And it's in a way comparing his body to a temple. That's interesting, because later on the apostle will say, don't you know that your body's a temple? So don't go to prostitutes and all that stuff in Corinth. Glorify God with your body. And where's he got that from? Body's a temple. Jesus says it too, obviously. He spoke of the temple of his body. I think we can see there too, the bottom line, this is my lover and this is my friend. I think our generation has forgotten that message. Pornography has taken us towards the lover thing flat out, but we've forgotten the friend thing. And one of the genius wisdom moments of the Song of Songs is when the woman says that, I think. Because she's saying, this man is incredibly beautiful and sexy, but he's also my best friend. And there you have, I think, the ideal of Christian marriage. Trust plus godly lust, if you want to put it in that way. And there's a lot there, I think, in that. There's one question that everybody asks. Let me answer that one, in my view, first, and then let's use a few minutes to have some Q&A. And I apologize that I haven't given you more time. Everybody always asks me, how come the guy with 1,000 lovers he writes a book about love? Why is he an expert? Isn't he the worst person to write about that? Great question. My answer would be, the rabbis tell us that Solomon writes the Song of Songs when he's young and in love, that he writes Proverbs when he's in his middle age and very, very wise, and he writes Ecclesiastes when he's old. And he's been, for a long period, an apostate against God. He's been a follower of other religions for a long time. And somebody gives him a big bump. Personally, I think it's Ethan the Ezrahite in Psalm 89 when he writes this brilliant attack on the king, a very risky, risky psalm, from the second smartest man in Solomon's kingdom, Ethan the Ezrahite. But Solomon comes back to God and he writes Ecclesiastes. Okay? But that's what the rabbis tell us. Now, if that's true, then we've got Solomon. Now, if that's true, we've got the guy with 700 wives and 300 unofficial concubines, but he doesn't write one word about that. He doesn't write one word about that. You know, bring back on Tuesday night that redhead that came. Well, I've forgotten the name. Bring her back. Nothing about that. He just chooses to record this one relationship he had with one beautiful, committed marriage. And that, I think, in itself is the message. A guy who's had 1,000 lovers and lived like one of the Rolling Stones and could boast about all these women that he's taken to bed, doesn't. He finds all that foolishness and a waste of time and godless, joyless, and sad. And instead chooses to write about his first beautiful marriage. And I think that's a powerful, powerful point. Questions or comments briefly before we wrap?
Just say, Tim Keller has written the book The Meaning of Marriage. And Juliet and I read that together, and may I recommend it?
Thank you. The Meaning of Marriage. Thanks for that. Questions or comments, anyone? Sorry, the question, just for the tape, is, should you be careful about who you study with this with? I think it's a great question. In my chapter on preaching the song, I make the suggestion that you do church for adults occasionally. And you have a great activity for the children planned off to the side. Parents can go if they want, but you take care of the kids. And some churches do this every week. But if you want to talk about these adult issues, you do it in it. And you also give people warning so that if somebody who has some pain on these issues wants to stay away, they can. If somebody, but I think too, I think with an adult, I'm not suggesting you teach this to 10-year-olds, but then again, in my country, the average age at which a person accesses pornography used to be 11. It's now 8.5. It's now 8.5. And so they're seeing some of the sick things on screen and seeing group sex and whipping, and I don't even want to go into it. So in a sense, there's a role, I think, more and more for teaching this younger and younger. Now, yes, I'd want parental permission. I wouldn't want to just inflict it on parents. But it's a good question, Andy, that there's got to be some pastoral wisdom put into how we teach this. Yeah, I think you're right. Can I just stand on one leg and tell you in a very quick summary what I've tried to say today? I think the Christian church has been misrepresented. Christian teaching on sex seems much more weird and dark and foolish, and I think it's time we turn that around. I think, first of all, teaching the Song of Songs might give Christians a stronger, more positive worldview in the area of sex, and that's vitally needed. Second of all, if we had that, I think we might represent our awesome God to people much more positively. And I think, you know, in another way, this whole song doesn't tell you the ultimate in love. It's not the ultimate love story. Your ultimate experience of love will not be in a ripping good marriage. And for the record, I consider myself incredibly blessed to be married to who I'm married to and to have the marriage I have. But even with that, there's a better love experience coming when you and I love and see Christ face to face. And I think, in a way, that's what this whole thing is pointing to. But that's not to minimize human love. I think what this is trying to say to us is that it's one of God's gifts from Eden. It's one of the original things God made for the human race. And he said, be fruitful and multiply and become one flesh. And that's still good. Even in the fallen world, that's still potentially awesome. And I think it shows us God's purposes. I'm screening a film tonight called Sex and the Soul, where I interview a bunch of porn stars and Christian sexologists and all that kind of stuff, looking at this topic, trying to do what I've advocated doing in this class today. Love you to be there. Love your comments in discussion afterwards. But one of the telling comments is we interview this this Sri Lankan Christian sexologist. She's a wonderful woman. She's a professor of sexology at a university in Australia, a public university, and a very committed conservative Christian and a stand-up comedian in her mid-60s. Hilarious lady. At the end of the interview, she says to us, I say, what do you think about God? And she says, God is standing there and the angels are saying, the clitoris, isn't the clitoris a bit too much? And God says, no, I'm going to let the clitoris be there because it is the one organ in the body that does nothing but give pleasure. And then she says, isn't it a good God that can design that? And you go, oh my word, she's absolutely right. If we're serious about the doctrine of creation, all the pleasure that comes from human love and sex is a gift of God, something he intends in the right context, protected by the walls of morality and commitment. And in a sense, I think sex can tell us about God. He could have made us to reproduce by wind-blown pollen. You know, we could have gone and blown a seed across the room or something. How boring would that have been? But instead he chose a method that was companionable and pleasurable and loving. And maybe that tells us a bit about his plans for us and who he is. I can only say I started reading it just before I was married, actually. Started studying it at a more serious level and teaching on it. And it's been a blessing. It's a constant source of discussion. I keep on seeing new things in it. I'll give you my best thoughts to date in this commentary, but ask me in 5 years, I think there's a lot more to learn. And all I can say is all scripture is given by inspiration of God and is useful, I think. And this is a classic example. Thanks for your company. God bless you in your own life and in your ministry and all of that good stuff. And we'll see you around.